times, in all things, and in all places. During the Battle of Karbala, Yazid, the corrupt tyrant and illegitimate ruler, killed Imam Hussein, the 7th century revolutionary leader who recorded a phenomenal, valiant stand for social and political justice. Fast forward to our times, we see that the current victories of the Axis of resistance over imperialist arrogance illustrate one of Ashura's core issues, the triumphs of the oppressed over the oppressors. After more than 1400 years, Imam Hussein still has the capability to awaken the oppressed people to heroically resist and to never bow to a hegemonic power. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah once said that the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the victories of the Islamic resistance Hezbollah against the occupation, as well as against all Takfiri terrorist groups, was made possible through Ashura's logic, spirit, and determination, which are still very much active and present. To commemorate Ashura means to acquire knowledge on how to confront tyranny and how to disable the fundamental goals of the Zionists and the imperialists. It teaches us that only resistance can manage to prevent those enemies from achieving their colonial goals. Out of his moral obligation and principles of social and political justice, Imam Hussein refused to pledge allegiance to Yazid's corruption and repression, despite it being a risk to his life. He chose to make a phenomenal stand and launched the mighty uprising alongside with his family and 72 of his sincere companions. Knowing that what was ahead of them was a certain martyrdom, they all remained steadfast, loyal to their principles, and fought valiantly against the army of Yazid. Undoubtedly, Imam Hussein headed to Iraq not to seek power, but to reform and restructure the Islamic Muhammadan state and its universal humanitarian ethics. Ethics, steadfastness, faith, and perseverance that we witnessed in our era at the behest of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, Ansarullah in Yemen, and various other revolutionary movements in Syria, Palestine, and across the Arabian Peninsula. Imam Hussein's teachings are inextricably linked to the inherent human characteristics of those who seek liberty and dignity. As shown by his tremendous act of devotion, Imam Hussein won the souls and hearts of all free men in Karbala. So did the Axis of Resistance that has always been greatly inspired by the outstanding figure of Imam Hussein bin Ali, peace be upon him. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Every year, millions of people across the world, especially in West Asia, participate in the mourning ceremonies for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the Arba'in March, a phenomenon that has drawn attention in academic circles in terms of anthropology. Scientists and researchers shed light on the driving force behind the solidarity among Shias all over the world, especially during Muharram rituals. However, Muharram's importance is not limited to a social phenomena. It's also of political importance and has played a significant role in mobilizing the people in our region against the U.S. and its main ally, Israel. The Ashura uprising is the underlying ideology of the Axis of Resistance, which aims to confront the U.S. and Israeli arrogance, just as Imam Hussein alayhi salam confronted Yazid's arrogance and oppression. To discuss this issue, with us from Qum in Iran is Sheikh Muzaffar Haidari, Creative Director at Islamic Pulse. Thank you very much, Maulana, for being with us on this very special occasion. Now, beginning with the legacy of Ashura, if you were to say that the Ashura uprising is the underlying ideology of the Axis of Resistance, which aims basically to confront the U.S. policies in West Asia and also the arrogance of the Israeli entity, just as Imam Hussein bin Ali, peace be upon him, confronted the tyrant at his time, Yazid, the arrogant Yazid and the oppressive Yazid. How realistic do you think this kind of a comparison is?
Oh, absolutely. It is absolutely realistic. And I couldn't say it really better than you just said it right there. For many people, I think we need to be aware is that for them, the legacy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, unfortunately, is relegated to just shedding tears for Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. And so we see that many people go out and they commemorate and they cry, they recite eulogies. But it is very important for us as Muslims to remember what the real message behind it was. And to put it briefly in a nutshell, we can put it into three kind of ways, three lessons that we can derive from the legacy of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The first is that we should never, ever, we should never fail to stand up against oppression. Wherever we see oppression taking place, we should stand up against it. And I say this to everybody out there, whether you are in school, if you're in school and you see bullying taking place, the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam should inspire you to stand up against that bullying. If you're in the workplace and you see some sort of abuse taking place, you should be inspired by the message of Imam Hussein alayhi salam to do something about it. And on the socio-political stage globally, if we see that oppression is taking place, we cannot remain silent. That's the first lesson. The second lesson is that we should be willing to sacrifice anything for the sake of standing up against that oppression. How do we learn this from Imam Hussein alayhi salam? Well, we see in the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam that he was actually willing to sacrifice not only his own life, not only was he willing to charge into battle alongside his companions. No, not only that, he was willing to put his family on the line. He was willing to put his reputation on the line. He was ready to sacrifice his wealth and everything that he had in order to ensure that justice was established in society. That's the second lesson. The third lesson that we can derive from the legacy of Imam Hussein and Karbala is that we should never be afraid of tyrannical powers. The famous line of Imam Hussein alayhi salam where he said, "Ala wa inna ad-da'i ibn ad-da'i kadaraqazni bayna athnatayn bayna as-sillati wad-dhilla wa hayhat min ad-dhilla." He said, "Surely the illegitimate son of the illegitimate father has placed me between these two, between death and humiliation, and never will we accept humiliation." Mm-hmm. This is our slogan, therefore.
From here, Mawlana, I want to pass on to talk about how these three lessons were the ideology of the axis of resistance in West Asia, because Ashura Uprising had many lessons, as you just demonstrated to us, one of which is that everyone should participate in the battle against wrong. In Karbala, the battle against the wrong was obvious, it was clear. But today, it seems more complicated than that. What do you think is the major challenge facing the axis of resistance in its current battle against the wrong?
You see, it's a really interesting point. We have to actually debate about this. Was it really more confusing in the past, or is it more confusing now? Some would argue, as you put it so clearly just then, that actually in today's time, it's much more confusing. Our imam is in ghiba, whereas in that time, they had a zahir imam who was telling them what was right and what was wrong. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, you know, back in those times, things were much more simple. Today, due to media and due to all sorts of plots of the enemies, some can argue that it's become much more confusing. But actually, when we look at what's happening on the global political stage, can we really deny that America is evil, that America is the great Satan, that America is the source of most of, if not all, of the conflicts we see erupting in the world today? I'd argue that actually it's become way more clear in today's age, and progressively, as time progresses, we're seeing that it's becoming more and more clear. But here, I'd like to add this, that Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic resistance and the Islamic revolution, has emphasized over years, if not decades, on the importance and significance of the soft war. That's the battle for the minds of the masses using cyberspace, And more recently, he's been talking about jihad tabiin, the jihad, the struggle, the striving of clarification. And so when we see that plots are being hatched by the enemies to confuse people, just like they were confused in the past, to mislead people, just like they were misled in the past, we have to play an active role, as I believe you are, dear sister, and those other comrades out there in Press TV and other platforms too, and my comrades here in Islamic Pulse, to make the realities clear for the people out there.
Well, I want to add something else that Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. He said on October 13, 2019, during a speech delivered at the Military University of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he said, "The Arba'een March is the power of Islam, the power of the truth, and the power of the Islamic resistance front." In what ways does the Arba'een March fuel the ideology of the axis of resistance in our region?
Well, we have to recognize that, first and foremost, this is the biggest, the single biggest yearly gathering of human beings on the planet. There is no gathering, no commemoration which hails more numbers than the Arba'een demonstrations. So it really is a fantastical phenomenon that we are witnessing in the world today, where you see 30, 40 million plus individuals coming from all over the world to commemorate and to show that they stand labaik. Phenomenon. And we should recognize that this is something that the enemies are terrified of. There may be a lot of celebrities out there. There may be a lot of politicians out there who apparently seem to be popular and as though they can get things done in the world on a global scale. But actually, the reality is that when it comes to the crunch, when it comes to people actually sacrificing their time, their money, their effort, going away from their homes, traveling vast distances, who in the world can get masses of individuals to do that? That too, on a yearly basis. The fact that the Shia world, the Muslim world, has this power frightens the enemies massively. In the future, inshallah, this same energy, zeal, spirit, and political foresight can be used against the very enemies who try to destroy the Shia faith and the Islamic faith today, and they are the very same inheritors of the legacy of the likes of Yazid.
I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Muzaffar Haidari, a creative director and producer at the Islamic Pulse from Qom, Iran, for joining us to talk about this very crucial matter. I wish we had more time, but I promise that we give it more time next time. Thank you for being with us, and please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Hezbollah's Ashura legacy.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Ashura has been commemorated in many different ways across time, region, and historical contexts. Today, I want to shed light on one particular practice of Ashura, that of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. One of the highlights of Hezbollah's Ashura commemorations are the speeches of its Secretary General, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, a speech that stands apart from his many speeches given at other commemorations and events occurring throughout the year. These speeches are of high importance because they have various performative implications and are a symptom of a more general ideological production of the party itself that is actually conducive to collective resistance action, fusing together the religious, the political, and the military. Hezbollah's Ashura legacy in this following report.
The history of nations cannot be separated from their present.
History in its path is composed of the accumulations and experiences that shape a society's character. It was indeed subjected to changes that modified its path, but these changes turned into main elements of the nation's collective consciousness. The history of Ashura did exactly that. Karbala was not only a historical event, but was an epic that included all the values, concepts, and truths of religion: faith, love, truth, justice, generosity, sacrifice, and patience. Virtues that are still present in our times, mainly embodied by oppressed nations who choose to fight for liberty. Namely, Hezbollah in Lebanon. Fighting for liberty is not only attained through acts of war in battlefields, but also through culture and public speech. Hezbollah's Ashura, and specifically through the speeches of its Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, aim at linking identity formation, namely a sense of belonging to a community, to the cultivation of certain set of skills or ethics drawn from Ashura. Identity formation is subservient to the cultivation of ethics and specific skills conducive to social and militant action. In the case of Hezbollah, a sense of belonging brings the community together in order to have a common objective in facing the enemy, just as Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his family and companions did in Karbala 1400 years ago. Hezbollah's Ashura is not simply an attempt by a political organization to use a religious commemoration in order to advance certain political goals. Hezbollah's Ashura signals an excellent example of the blurry boundaries of categories of the religious and the political when it comes to the teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Sayyid Nasrullah invites the listener in Ashura to engage in a spiritual exercise. This process involves the cultivation of a knowledge that is conducive to a quality of living. It aims at producing the right state of consciousness, most specifically the skills of firmness and decisiveness in dealing with challenges ahead. Sayyid Nasrullah's sermon-like speeches tend to blend religious motives with political analysis and ethical lessons. While Ashura has often been used as a platform to express certain community concerns, the political speech during Hezbollah's Ashura has become a cornerstone of the commemoration of Imam Hussein's uprising.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Sheikh Sadiq Nablusi, professor of political science, author, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mawlana. Now, Hezbollah's Ashura, and specifically through the speeches of the Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, aim at linking identity formation, namely a sense of belonging to a community, to the cultivation of certain set of skills and of ethics. The main audience are both the community of Hezbollah at large and the resistance mujahideen. It is understood why mujahideen are actually influenced by the speeches of Sayyid Nasrullah, but what about the public community? How do you see them being influenced by the school of Karbala through the speeches of Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. No doubt Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah is the most ingenious, skilled, professional, and able to draw history into contemporary reality. He brought the Karbala legacy with all its values and concepts related to sacrifice and love, altruism and giving, to the reality of the life we live today. This life that is filled with challenges and risks against Muslims and all humanity. Which is why Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah was the man who reflected the ethics of Ashura towards the public. He managed to bring the image closer to the mind of the people and put before people the dangers they are exposed to, from the injustice of rulers and from corruption. This is not only at the Lebanese level, but also at the regional level. Specifically, he diagnoses two great rulers, or two great tyrants, the United States of America and the Israeli enemy. Hence, why audiences interact with him greatly, because what the people of this region are going through, from occupation to aggression to the theft of their resources and land, all this touches the reality being lived by the public. That is why, when he conveys the historical experience of Karbala and presents to the public the sacrifices of Imam Hussein in order to make this tyrant confused and anxious, leading to the failure of the enemy. This means that Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah represents Imam Hussein in his basic ethics and values and seeks to embody those values in the contemporary reality. He wants to challenge the contemporary tyranny as Imam Hussein challenged the old tyrant who was represented by Yazid.
Exactly. That's not the only thing that Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah invites the listener in Ashura to engage. He invites them to engage in spiritual exercise. This is what he calls it. This process involves the cultivation of knowledge that is conducive to a quality of living. It aims at producing the right state of consciousness, just like you told us, but more specifically the skills of firmness and decisiveness. So can it be said that without Ashura, Hezbollah could have not been able to sustain hard challenges and maybe maintain firm support from his cohorts?
There is no doubt that Ashura is filled with values that call for will, patience, and endurance, filled with real determination and firmness towards the enemy, who usurped legitimacy and usurped the dignity and rights of the people. When these values are promoted in real life, people tend to have this strength and this great ability to face challenges. Without the values of Ashura, it would have been very difficult for the Secretary General of Hezbollah or for any revolutionary movement to survive and continue in this glow and brilliance, because the level of challenges and dangers faced by Muslims and vulnerable societies in Africa, in Latin America, and in our region is at a very high level. So we need higher values of these challenges so as to come out and overcome these challenges and inspire the masses with patience, strength, and power. For example, martyrdom is a real and great value for Muslims. So when we inject into the awareness of the public the importance of martyrdom, this public will then know how rights and dignity can be restored, how wealth can be recovered. Without these values that were embodied by Imam Hussein in Karbala, it would have been very difficult to invite people and bring them the image of this heroic and brave act.
Well, by emulating the actions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala and cultivating a connection with his love and eagerness for the afterlife, for martyrdom, can one safely say that it has been instrumental for Hezbollah to connect Ashura to recruiting fighters and to conducting successful military operations, or rather, it directly had to do with the imminent risk and danger that the villages and the families of these fighters were exposed to because of the Israeli entity's aggression?
Karbala is a good recipe for human life and a good recipe for human dignity. Imam Hussein wanted to restore the real life of human beings. Therefore, when people at this time see that the Israeli enemy or the United States of America or the countries of Western domination stealing their wealth, occupying their land, and committing crimes and atrocities against their children and families, then yes, they find that they need such values. Thus, today, we know the extent of the tyranny practiced by the United States of America and the extent of the tyranny practiced by Israel. That is why today the world is divided into a tyrannical world and a divine humanistic world. People have to research and choose in which side to stand. Do they want to stand with the side that wants to penetrate with tyranny and corruption, or do they want to stand on the side of the truth, even if this requires a lot of effort and sacrifices? Karbala raises the status of man. It restores to man the kingdom of faith and good life. You want to reinforce in the public the values of strength, courage, altruism, and honesty, because without these values, one can never regain a village, or restore land, or face an enemy and expel it from his land. Therefore, yes, these values enhance the stability of societies and peoples on their land and raise the level of their morale, faith, and sacrifices in the face of the enemy, so that they can impose their will against the will of the enemy, expel the enemy, and nullify the plans of the enemy who wants to divide people and seek strife between human societies. This is what the enemy does.
Thank you very much for your contribution and your time, Sheikh Sadiq Nablusi, Professor of Political Sciences, author and political commentator. And to you, from the heart, I give you great condolences for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his family and his companions in this year's Muharram in Ashura. Thank you very much for being with us. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Condolences to all of you for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein ibn Ali and his family members and his companions. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Pentagon contractors operating in Afghanistan over the past two decades raked in nearly $108 billion, funds that were distributed and spent with a significant lack of transparency, according to a report published recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Pentagon Contractors in Afghanistan Pocketed $108 Billion Over 20 Years. Pentagon contractors operating in Afghanistan over the past two decades raked in nearly $108 billion, funds that were distributed and spent with a significant lack of transparency, according to a report published recently. These contracts show the shadowy camel economy at work in Afghanistan, said report author Heidi Peltier, director of programs for the Cost of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. She said, military contracting obscures where and how taxpayer money flows, who profits, and how much is lost to waste, fraud, and abuse. It also makes it difficult to know how many people are employed, injured, and killed through military contracting. Based on Peltier's review of public contracting databases, USAS spending.government and the Federal Procurement Data System, just over a dozen U.S. Department of Defense, DOD, contractors got more than $44 billion, or about 41% of almost $108 billion from 2002 to this year. As the document details, in addition, thousands of smaller companies earned billions in contract spending, and about one-third of the contracts, in dollar terms, went to companies that are listed as undisclosed or miscellaneous in data. These designations result from the contracts being given to foreign companies without a DUNS number, or they are undisclosed with national security or protection as a claimed rationale for secrecy. Whatever the reason, this creates and opacity that makes it impossible to know who exactly received U.S. taxpayer funds, what work was performed, how much profit was earned, and whether the intended purposes of the contracts were served. Inadequate oversight, coupled with the issue of subcontracting, results in a system in which the U.S. government pays contractors who then leave a trail of spending that is nearly impossible to follow. The analysis notes a number of companies perform services in Afghanistan under multiple different business names. A generous interpretation of this is that the businesses pursuing such practices were in fact performing different services. A less generous interpretation is that businesses can obscure how many contracts they are receiving, as well as circumvent issues of intelligibility by operating under different names. The report emphasizes that almost $108 billion that Peltier focused on is in addition to the trillions of dollars spent on DoD contracts performed in the U.S. over that period. The contractors examined by Peltier were paid for construction, lodging, office supplies, refrigeration equipment, transportation, waste disposal, and weapons maintenance in the war-torn country. They operated various facilities such as dining and troop housing and were contracted for accounting, fuel, food, guard, and surveillance services. During their nearly two-decade U.S. occupation, the analysis states contractors provided all types of goods and services that were essential to the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, including services such as weapons, maintenance, and fuel supply that made the U.S. military dependent on and arguably vulnerable to the performance of contractors. Most contracts for work in Afghanistan ended or were rescinded by August 31, 2021, when U.S. troops fully withdrew, the report says, adding, some contract presence may remain, though it is difficult to know which companies and how many employees could still be working in service of the U.S. government in that country. Transparency is a major focus of the document, which highlights that lack of oversight by the Department of Defense, combined with waste, fraud, and abuse on the part of both contractors and government employees, resulted in billions of misallocated and misspent taxpayer dollars. The analysis cites reports by the Department of Defense Inspector General, DODIG, and Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR. In one case involving insufficient voucher reviews for a major contract from 2015 to 2017, the new report notes 1/5 of them had questionable or undocumented expenses totaling over $536 million. In another case, SIGAR found that a subcontractor of Lockheed Martin submitted fraudulent invoices that resulted in overbilling the Department of Defense millions of dollars. Peltier's report also points to government watchdogs' findings of incomplete and shoddy construction of school buildings, warehouses, and other facilities, as well as bribery of U.S. officials to secure contracts. SIGAR, in its quarterly report to Congress this past January, conservatively estimated nearly 30% of U.S. appropriations for Afghanistan reconstruction from 2009 to 2019 was lost to waste, fraud, and abuse. The Pentagon was responsible for the bulk of that spending. The Brown analysis explains that the overpayment of illegitimate expenses and the lack of oversight of contracts by Department of Defense was compounded by yet another problem. In some cases, contractors were hired to perform oversight of other contractors, in lieu of the oversight that should have been performed by the U.S. Department of Defense. Peltier told responsible statecraft, which exclusively reported on the new document, that the DODIG also found oversight by the Department of Defense itself to be insufficient or poorly executed. So really, the oversight problems are both the fox guarding the hen house as well as internal issues, which in some cases are because of corruption and in other cases just poor execution. The researchers suggested that to help prevent abuse, there should be a committee or other body to make determinations of whether certain contracts can legitimately be labeled as undisclosed. I would recommend the Department of Defense reduce its contracting overall and return to providing more services in-house, Peltier added, referencing services like weapons maintenance and security, but also things like food services and lodging, in order to have more command in fulfilling its own needs and reduce the use of contracts and the opportunities for waste, fraud, and abuse. In a statement recently, Stephanie Saville, co-director of the Cost of War Project, put Peltier's findings about Pentagon contractor spending into a broader context. $100 billion is an enormous amount of money, but it's also just a drop in the bucket when it comes to the full cost of the post-9/11 war, Saville noted. Adding, nearly a million people have lost their lives in these wars, and U.S. taxpayers have paid over $2.3 trillion for the war in Afghanistan alone, and over $8 trillion total for the post-9/11 wars in other places as well. She said, it's shocking that the U.S. government hasn't had a serious reckoning with the U.S. militarized counterterrorism model and its human and financial cost over the past two decades.
Chest beating to the sound of drums is a familiar sound early each Muharram. It goes on till Tasua and Ashura, the 9th and 10th days of the lunar month, when Imam Hussein was ruthlessly beheaded during his mission to Karbala. That's in Iran and Shia Muslim areas everywhere mourning this grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, named Master of Martyrs. The incident fell to August the 7th and 8th this year. Ashura is an epic tale with true characters, which till today inspire Shias to fight for what they know to be true and just. How their movements were formed and who else participated we'll be touching upon here in Iran today with me, Leila Faramarzi.
Thank you.
At the time of the Umayyad Caliphate, Hussein ibn Ali, grandson of the Prophet of Islam, decided to rise against the second Umayyad Caliph, Yazid ibn Muawiyah. He announced time and again that the reason for his uprising was that Yazid was destroying Islam, a religion and message his grandfather Muhammad, peace be upon him, had brought from God. He intended to rescue Islam by taking over the rulership and having the true Islam practiced in society. On the path to this divine goal, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and his 72 loyal companions were finally martyred by Yazid's army in an excruciating fashion in the year 680 AD or 61 Hijra. As for the Imam's family, surviving family members, they were taken hostage. In fact, the Ashura legacy lies at the heart of the Muslim resistance today. Also earlier, Hussein's uprising and blood inspired the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran and Iranians' resistance during the 1980s war that followed, as well as today's fight against Takfiri groups. Mr. Jamshidi made it a point to come to the studio on holiday Tasua for better clarity.
You cannot adopt all parables in your life, but when you look at the culture of Ashura as a parable, you see that people try to adopt it to their lives. As a result, in the Iranian society, we can find traces of the Ashura events where the people of Iran have been put in a similar position and acted as Imam Hussein did, which means they have recreated that event. Therefore, we are not talking about a strictly historical event that has passed and is inadaptable today. It is an event that is repeatable in the context of a society's historical movements.
The eight-year Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s was suffering enough to inspire the creation of a defense museum, after a visit to which you can't not stand in awe. All creeds and walks went to fight, but the Shia majority of this population no doubt were inspired by the Ashura uprising, given as they don't forget their rites and rituals, even in time of war. In fact, the Iraq-Iran War is called the Holy Defense against an offensive by the then Ba'athist Iraq. Collectively, the aforementioned Muslim resistance is an axis of resistance comprised of the Lebanese Hezbollah and Iran, Palestine and Syria. It works as a political and informal military alliance to rid the region and the world of oppression and U.S. imperialism by direct U.S. involvement or by the hands of U.S. allies, be they Western or West Asian Israelis or Saudis. And it has seen success in proving how every despot will meet death one day. Current victories of the resistance over imperialist arrogance illustrate one of Ashura's core issues. That's the triumphs of the oppressed over oppressors. Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance, as part of the axis of resistance, managed to defeat U.S.-backed regional powers who invaded and imposed an unconditional global war on Syria.
Today, neither America nor Israel hold any power or capabilities and not the courage to attack the Iranian nation. All people should know this. Whoever hears me, I'm not saying this today. I said the same thing in an interview as the Iranian ambassador to Syria during the Israeli war against the people of Lebanon. I declared it then as well. After the defeat of Israel against Hezbollah, Israel doesn't have the capacity to stand against and attack the nation of Lebanon. After the 33 days war, Israel doesn't have the power to attack Lebanon again, and it doesn't now.
The resistance is not a fight just for Shias, but anyone in the region striving for independence and dignity. And Sunni Muslim scholars also testify to the noble character of the Imam as a companion of the Prophet, according to Muhammad al-Zubi. He's a Lebanese Islamic scholar who says, "All Yazid's crimes are embodied in the Zionist regime U.S. axis, and we find the Husseini nobility in the axis of the Islamic Republic and the resistance movement." No event is known to have rallied crowds more than Ashura, although Corona over past years may have seen it subdued but not stopped. In Iran, large congregations recite elegies and lament as they beat their chests, but with an eye to life and making it better for your fellow human. They distribute free food and organize charitable campaigns, as well as blood donation campaigns, as if to make up for blood spilled on the battlefield all those centuries ago. In Karbala alone, some 22 million Shias gather to pay homage to Imam Hussein.
We have a unique and extraordinary gathering called Arba'in, which is itself the symbol of resistance and has a symbolic and epic capacity of extraordinary proportions, so much that it gathers around 20 million population or more from different nationalities and different sects, and sometimes from entirely different religious backgrounds with no intervention from governments or governmental call to action. All of a sudden, everyone gathers and moves from Najaf to Karbala in an extraordinary fashion, and it has everything to do with resistance. It actualizes the theory of resistance in practice. It is a symbol and visage, a glimpse of what an Islamic civilization will look like if it were to form. Which historical event has such epic capacity to promote resistance? Does it not make you wonder?
The question arises, why did the Imam have his family, including a baby, with him to begin with? One of the most certain answers to this question is that the people of Kufa invited Imam Hussein to rule them, which meant a long stay in Kufa, which would in turn require the presence of the women and children in his family. Also, if they hadn't been there, history might have been corrupted, and in judging the Ashura uprising, some would claim that the Imam had intended to go to war from the start, which is why he'd headed for Kufa without his women and children. Actually, many believe the fact that the women and children were taken hostage in the Karbala uprising means the Master of Martyrs was righteous in his cause and fell victim to the cruelty of Yazid's army, such that they showed no mercy even to Hussein Abu Abdullah's six-month-old baby, Ali Asghar, and martyred him.
Imam Hussein ham ruye hamin.
The most basic element of justice is the appointment of a righteous figure as the leadership of governments and societies. And when Imam Hussein sees that an invalid and incompetent figure is at the highest levels of the Islamic society and government, he said that al-Islam as-salam, which means this Islam and a society, that a person like Yazid, who had no qualities to be appointed to that post and had no qualities to be the warden of Muslims, then the end for that society and that Islam is near, and we must rise against the oppression that is being exacted upon the society.
Exodus is a form of opposition in Western terms, which means Imam Hussein was the opposition to the existing order. When he says, I made my exodus, it means I am the opposition, I am dissenting, and I am the opponent. I do not accept the rules of the game, and whatever you do, I will not pledge allegiance. This means exodus, an uprising. When I said it has such capacity for epic, it means if you were to be placed in the same historical context and predicament, and the existing political order was imposed on you and said you should choose one between death and acceptance, Imam Hussein says, I choose death. This isn't distortion, it's Ashura itself. From Mecca to Medina and the speeches he made and the letter he wrote, it is obvious. The basis for the movement was political objection, an objection to the structure, not just Yazid himself.
Charles Dickens, the ingenious English novelist, says, if Hussein had fought to quench his worldly desires, then I do not understand why his sister, wife and children accompanied him. It stands to reason, therefore, that he sacrificed purely for Islam. Certainly, the Imam was headed to Iraq to reform and reorganize the Islamic State and its universal humanitarian Mohammedan ethics of solidarity and sacrifice for freedom and dignity, for social and political justice. Yet more incidents and occasions inspired by the Tasua Ashura event and uprising coming up, but only after a quick diversion into the world of media. Now, as for how it's going to be with Corona this year, Iqtisad News reads that ceremonies will be held. They were never totally shut down, and this year the Corona Combat Headquarters has just advised mourning in open spaces with good ventilation. What it has ordered is that in enclosed spaces, the color code determining how hazardous Corona is in each area be observed. Red category or corona-ridden cities are to hold their religious ceremony at 30% capacity, orange cities at 50%, and yellow cities at 70%. Blue cities are okay to congregate at full capacity, but while observing protocol. Walking all the way to Karbala is a thing for Iranians in Muharram. And there's no restriction on ground travels from Iran to Iraq in Muharram this year, as announced in July by Tasnim News. No restriction on ground travels, and Iranian pilgrims planning to visit Iraq to observe Muharram mourning ceremonies can leave via land border crossings individually or in groups without any limitations. The chairman of the Arbaeen Central Headquarters of Iran announced that according to agreements with the Interior Ministry of Iraq, Iranian pilgrims will be allowed to travel to Iraq by land via Mehran and Shalamche border crossings during the lunar month of Muharram. Majid Mir Ahmadi said they can travel to the Iraqi cities of Najaf and Karbala individually or in groups. He also noted Iranian travelers going to Iraq will be required to carry valid passports and coronavirus vaccination certificates. In June, Iraq removed visa requirements for pilgrims going to the Arab country by land for Arbaeen rituals. Each year, pilgrims, mainly from Iraq and Iran, travel long routes on foot to Karbala, where the holy shrine of Imam Hussein is located. This is referring mostly to the walk from Najaf to Karbala. That'll be for the news section today. You stay tuned. Talking of movements with the Ashura uprising as their underlying ideology, the axis of resistance, so to speak, what might even have alerted them to that saintly uprising and what it represents? Well, members and followers do attend the annual mourning ceremony, which is so much more. And that is occasion for sermons and summons by the clergy.
What our contemporary Iranian thinkers did was a reinterpretation of Shiism, which means bringing Shiism to the present time, presenting a social revolutionary narrative of resistance. This capacity existed before, but it was ever or never reinterpreted in such a way. This was a result of figures like Shariati. Really, the efforts he made and the narrative he presented from Ashura made the people connect the dots to their present lives. When they say opposition to the West and imperialism and capitalism and so on, this notion was understood by the people of Iran as early as the 60s. So Ashura is not eating rice or qaymeh and such rudimentary things, regardless of the political order and its direction. No, there is a real conflict here.
In a speech in June 1963, Imam Khomeini, founder of Iran's Islamic Revolution, compared the Shah to Yazid, while denouncing him as a puppet of American and Israeli masters. And Imam Hussein's slogan, "Never to humiliation," became the motto of the revolution. Why the nation may have felt humiliated is legal protections afforded to Americans in Iran as an intolerable capitulation of Iran's sovereignty. Although the capitulation bill was quickly reversed.
Our opposition to oppression caused a confrontation between us, our people and the revolutionary clergymen versus the Pahlavi regime. And then the stooge of this regime, the Shah, was expelled from Iran and then shut down the embassy of the entity that was trying very hard to maintain him, promoting oppression in the society. Now here the oppressive global system creates a problem for us, including war. So it wants to finish us off with a war and return our pursuit of justice, freedom and independence of the Iranian people to its former state before the revolution and direct it as it pleases.
Now, to what extent have the people seen mottos and their expectations of a revolution inspired by Ashura materialize? Where do you see this justice-seeking spirit among Iran's Shia nation of today?
The people of Iran are majority Shia. Shiites have Ali in their historical background, an imam who is said to have been killed because of his intensity in justice. So this is in the background of the Shia. In our perspective and prospect for the future, they are waiting for an imam that is said will fill the earth with justice. to the same extent that it is now filled with oppression and injustice. Therefore, Shiites hold the notion of justice as a very important and fundamental element.
The U.S.'s dual policy of sanctioning Iran while calling it to the negotiating table since 2018 has paired up with its cyber war on this country, aimed at driving dissent and widening a rift between our people and government. But whatever happens, there are enough people mourning Ashura's heroes each year to bring everyone together in the face of America. Black banners shrouding Iranian cities is proof of this. And America unknowingly narrowed the people versus government rift more than once, when it assassinated General Soleimani and when it threatened to strike cultural centers in this country.
I think the active components of a culture will emerge during historical crises. The uprising of Ashura is like this. In all these instances, even regarding pro-government rallies of December 30th, 2009, also known as the Day 9th Epic, the leader of the revolution has an interpretation. He says, the spirit of Imam Hussein assisted the Iranian nation. This refers to late 2009. Even that part of Iran's history, as soon as the mourning processions were harassed, everything changed. It messed with all political calculations. Previous alignments meant nothing then. How? Is a single event really so powerful to absorb everything else with its existence? Why did Day 9 March take place? Was it a call by the government? Was it a calling by religious leaders? Was it a pre-planned political scheme? No, it was caused by the harassment of mourning processions by a few, and the people did not stand for it.
Anyhow, the fight against imperialism and internal oppression triggered by popular dissatisfaction and rallied by clerical, independent political and literary voices goes way back to the Qajar era, which was from 1789 to 1925. A constitutional monarchy was called for, and the Persian Constitutional Revolution finally took place between 1905 and 1911. The revolution led to the establishment of a parliament in Persia or Iran during the Qajar dynasty. It did not happen overnight and did suffer casualty as many groups fought to shape the course of the revolution.
The struggles of the Iranian nation during the Persian Constitutional Revolution era and before that, in different stages after that until today, are rooted in the teachings of Ashura. Wherever the people of Iran have followed the teachings of their religious leaders and saw that the path was just, they have marched forward with the chant of Imam Hussein, because Imam Hussein was a supporter of justice. Imam Hussein's red banner and also his green banner are for the defense of what is right and opposition to oppression. He rose against crimes against humans, villainy and terror. He opposed those who killed so many innocent Muslims and Shiites in different countries.
The king, Muzaffar ad-Din Shah Qajar, signed the 1906 constitution shortly before his death. But he was succeeded by Muhammad Ali Shah, who abolished the constitution and bombarded parliament in 1908 with Russian and British support. This led to another pro-constitutional movement. The constitutionalist forces marched to Tehran, forced Muhammad Ali Shah's abdication in favor of his young son Ahmad Shah, and re-established the constitution in 1909.
When I take a look at most movements and uprising of the people of Iran, especially in the contemporary era of history, I recognize Ashura's immense influence and inspiration. I mean, it's a central theme. One obvious and transparent example is the revolution of the people of Iran. How can you take a look at this revolution without seeing a trace of Ashura in it? If you look at the chants, it's significant. If you look at the leadership, it's a central theme. You can look at mosques and places of mourning as a social network structure. The biggest march before the revolution were the Tasua and Ashura. Symbolization, Hussein, Yazid, uprising, defeat, victory, martyrdom, sacrifice, both Imams and Shariati, Mutahari and others, the first-class figures of the revolution have all utilized the epic proportions of this event to promote social mobilization, which means no other events has been so remarkable. people. You can go back to the pre-Islamic revolution era when you take a look at 80 years of the war. A keyword that's repeated the most in the last will and testaments of martyrs is Imam Hussein and other notions of Ashura. It held the first rank.
The 19th and early to mid-20th centuries dealt a few sore blows to Iran with the rise of new imperialist powers with eyes on its resources and warm waters or north-south route aiming for India. Now, Iran has always been sore towards any threat to its independence and development, and so these imperialist policies could not go uncontrolled.
Even in the Qajar era, if you take a closer look in our history, the subject of the Reji Company and Talbot himself, you see that an unjust and colonialist contract was imposed upon us. Then here, the Shiite religious leadership and the people who followed their lead could not stand the fact that a foreign country has imposed an oppressive and disgraceful contract on us. An incompetent person called Nasiruddin Shah has undersigned this contract, which is totally one-sided and in their favor. In a situation, the late Mirza Shirazi issued the tobacco protest fatwa, and his ruling for sanctioning tobacco was so effective that it even influenced the royal court of Nasiruddin Shah and his wife, who refused to bring him hookahs anymore.